Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midnight two Sundays ago, wildfires roared through California's wine country, fanned by whipping winds. Residents had minutes, seconds, sometimes to flee. Napa and Sonoma and half a dozen other counties still smoldering, and so much damage done. 7,000 buildings reported destroyed. Whole neighborhoods leveled. 100,000 evacuated at the height of the fires. 42 dead. And the question, what now? What next? This hour on Point, we are toting up the damage and lessons learned in California's deadliest wildfires. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you, your family, friends witness the wildfires that exploded through California wine country? And what have we learned in all this destruction and loss? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have heard all kinds of stories out of California from the last week and a half, 2 weeks almost now. Here was winemaker Pierre Birbent in Napa talking with PBS NewsHour's Joanne Jennings on Monday, describing the fire and his efforts just to save his winery. Just one of many, many instances of people getting out by the skin of their teeth.
I jumped in my truck, came down, and when I was driving down, I saw the hill all flaming.
Two vineyard workers joined him to help save the estate's tasting room.
But the smoke was getting very thick, and the wind was very strong, and after an hour, we couldn't breathe anymore. It was like fighting a giant.
It was like fighting a giant, and much more than tasting rooms going down in the flames. We've all seen the images of neighborhoods, just home after home after home after home, just burnt down to nothing but ash. On CBS on Wednesday, Scott Alonso, the Sonoma County Department of Public Health, urged residents not to clean up or poke around homes that were destroyed.
Don't clean up right now. It's not safe. The toxic ash and the debris is harmful. We don't want you sifting through it. We don't want children in it. Do not touch it. Just keep a track of what's there, and then we can get involved working with you to clear it out.
Of course, people want to go home, but many of those homes simply gone. With us first today from Oakland, California, is Aaron Baldessari, reporter for the Mercury News in San Jose, California, and the East Bay Times in Walnut Creek. She's been reporting on the California fires since October 9th, when things really took off. Her latest story is headlined, Where Will They Go?, talking about evacuees scrambling to find temporary housing after so many homes were lost. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Aaron Baldessari in California, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
It just looks shocking from a distance. Are people in California, you're accustomed to wildfire, but are people still in shock about the extent of this damage?
It's devastating. This is certainly the deadliest fire in the state's history, and it's burned over 250,000 acres across Northern California. So it's certainly unprecedented in terms of the size and the scope.
You've been covering this for days and days, Aaron. Give us a sense of some of the vignettes of scenes that you saw, moments that you witnessed or that were described to you that capture just how dire and frightening this became.
Well, I think one of the most frightening aspects was that many people had no warning. So they woke up to sometimes backup batteries alerting them after their power had gone out. They saw embers coming down around them. The smoke was so thick, people couldn't see. I spoke to one family, their caregivers at a boarding care facility for kind of sort of like assisted living facility, and they had four people in their charge. And it was literally, mother, father, grandmother, and a seven-year-old boy who pushed these four residents from down wheelchairs, down a city block. They couldn't see. There were walls of flames encroaching on either side of them. People have described it as rivers of flames coming towards them, walls of flames. Everyone just leaving their neighborhoods at the same time. Roads being jammed, people running for their lives from their cars. Certainly a terrifying scene.
Here's just a little piece of that. A Santa Rosa resident driving through her neighborhood, which was completely on fire, posted this video to YouTube.
This is my neighborhood in flames.
You hear that roar outside her car? And here, a recording made by Yuba County resident Mike Veen as he and his roommate narrowly escaped the fire. Surrounding their home, as embers are literally swirling around them, they jump into their SUV and make their escape, ramming through the front gate to get away. This video, first aired by CBS 13 in Sacramento.
I can't breathe. We're gonna die, dude. We gotta get out of here.
And boom, ramming right through that front gate. Aaron Baldessari has been covering it for a couple of weeks nearly now. I mean, Aaron, some of these escapes were just a matter of seconds, and not everyone made it. People just died trying to get down their long driveway.
Yeah, you know, there's one family up in the Redwood Valley fire in Mendocino County, a 14-year-old girl who died, a mother who had her legs amputated due to the burns. Some people just didn't have enough time. They didn't get out quick enough. There's certainly been other harrowing tales of people who tried to battle the flames with garden hoses and shovels and buckets. But the fire was so hot and it came so fast that it destroyed, in some cases, one house but spared another that was right next to it, and then jumped across the street and decimated more houses. So it was really fast and a furious fire that can only be described as cruel in terms of those that were spared and those that were spurned.
I mean, we've heard of couples, older couples, jumping into swimming pools trying to survive this. I read about a couple that did both survive, another where one did not. Among the dead, Carmen Beriz, she was vacationing at a friend's home there in Santa Rosa. Smelled smoke after midnight. Within a minute, they had 30-foot flames around the house, came the reports, and she and her husband tried to escape by car, got stuck, couldn't, got in the swimming pool, were in there for 5 hours. Carmen did not have the strength to hold on. She died in the arms of her husband, 55 years. And here's her daughter, Monica, who survived on CBS Monday.
It was just a miracle that my father survived it. I wish my mom had had the stamina to make it just a little bit longer.
Aaron, I mean, it just sounds terrifying. Everybody's read about these stories of people trying to find refuge in their pools. What made a difference of whether you survived or not once you were in there? You're in water, so I guess you wouldn't burn, but you still have to keep your nose out to breathe.
Sometimes I think it's just luck and stamina. You know, it certainly depended on how quickly the fire burned around people. Sometimes the fires came through very quickly and left quickly and burned up the fuel that was available, the brush and leaves, but left the trees standing. In other cases, they would get into houses and burn the houses down. I saw one, this pen of goats that had survived, but they were, maybe 50 feet from a house that burned down and across, and were surrounded in all areas by places that had been destroyed, but miraculously, this pen of goats had been spared. So it was completely almost random in how the fire moved. In some cases, you saw cars that the windshields, the glass had been melted from the windshield, aluminum had been melted from the cars, and then, in the next house over, it looked like nothing happened.
Aluminum melted from the cars. Mark that. I read somewhere that aluminum doesn't melt unless it's over 1,000 degrees. And here you had melted aluminum wheels. Just kind of stunning, incredible. I want to say, how did this fire start? But it wasn't just one fire. What set this off, Aaron?
Well, investigators are still trying to determine an official cause for what started these fires. There were 14 separate fires that started Monday night. Our newspaper did a review of some of the calls that came in, and emergency radio traffic indicates that there were 10 different locations across the county over about 90 minutes, beginning around 9:20 p.m., that there were, sparking wires and problems with electrical systems. So it looked like there were a lot of down power lines that may have contributed to some, sparking some fires. And electrical arcing. People sort of describe seeing blue flashes of light and then seeing flames erupt quickly thereafter. There was tinder dry conditions. We had a very hot summer in the Bay Area, in North Bay in particular, at the end of August and beginning of September. And so that really dried out a lot of the fuel that was there, a lot of the brush. We had a very wet winter after several years of drought. So a lot of those trees had been weakened, but the wet winter allowed a lot of brush to grow. That all got dried out in the summer. We had very strong winds. They call them Diablo winds or devil winds. And they're hot, dry winds that come down from the Sierras and up from the Central Valley. And it's kind of like a blow dryer being blown in your face. It's a very warm wind, and they had, they were reporting gusts of over 60 miles an hour, but sustained winds, in the 30 and 40 mile an hour range. But that just helped fan the flames and gave plenty of oxygen to the fire to keep it going, and there was plenty of things for the fire to consume.
And now, people still waiting to get back into their homes, still being blocked off in many areas.
There's still mandatory evacuation orders. As of yesterday evening, I had seen mandatory evacuations in Sonoma County. But much of the fire has been contained, at least the largest fires are nearing containment. The Tubbs fire that ravaged Sonoma and parts of Napa is around 92% contained. The Pocket Fire in Sonoma County is 73% contained. The Atlas Fire was at 85% yesterday. So it's getting closer and closer.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier? So even when you're busy, you can still be smart about how you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the deadliest wildfires in California history, as far back as we know it anyway. We are toting up the damage, lessons learned, 42 deaths, the latest number I saw. That could grow, I suppose. Latest numbers coming out, 7,000 structures, many of them homes, destroyed there. More than a week of terror as people left with just seconds of safety sometimes before they could get out, or in some cases not get out. Here were fire trucks screaming down the streets of Santa Rosa on Monday, October 9th. And here's Mike Shukin, a firefighter from Berkeley, California, who was dispatched to the fire in Santa Rosa 2 days after it started. He was shocked at what he encountered. Here he is on CBS that Wednesday.
We're expecting to see a row of houses, a structure, a school, something we could save. You know, that was the most discouraging part, because that's what we do. We go out and we help people. At that point, there was no one to help.
Here was Allison Dettafoli visiting her parents' Santa Rosa home, completely burned to the ground. Here she is on CNN.
They're 85 years old, and I just don't know if they can rebuild. I mean, so many family heirlooms I've fought my whole life. I'm going to inherit these someday. This is what I'm going to pass down to my kids. Oh, God, I can't.
And here, California Governor Jerry Brown on Saturday after surveying Santa Rosa by helicopter.
This is truly one of the greatest, if not the greatest, tragedy that California's ever faced.
You can join us this hour. Have you watched in astonishment as these fires tore through Sonoma, Napa, beyond? Were you there? Did you see it or flee it? Did your friends, your family, and what were you thinking as we watched towns run for their lives, whole communities go down? Can you imagine a midnight knock and 30 seconds, a few minutes to get out, to leave everything behind? What is the lesson in these fires? Karen's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Karen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm from California. I was born there. I moved here 13 years ago after quite a long life there. There have always been fires in both Northern and Southern California in the fall, but not like this. My brother's house is in the path in Sebastopol, right adjacent to Santa Rosa. My cousins who live 40 miles away have ash on their deck. I couldn't fly out of San Francisco on Wednesday because of smoke 67 miles away.
Wow.
It's very, very unusual. My question, which may not be appropriate for this particular discussion in this panel, but I hope you'll do a program on it if not, is what are the effects of climate change on this, on these conditions, and is there a way to turn back? My brother doesn't think they are. There is. My brother thinks we're finished. That we
What does he mean by that? Finished? Who's finished, Karen, and why? What does he mean?
My brother thinks that we've so destroyed our environment that these conditions that are happening around the world, such as hurricanes and fires, are here to stay, and it's a matter of time before we don't exist anymore. I can't buy into that just because I have to be more hopeful than that. But, I mean, I have grandchildren. But I would like to hear from you or your panel of the effects of climate change on these conditions and what can we do.
Let us bookmark that, and we will pick it up, Karen. I mean, I'm reading here the headline on an editorial in the Los Angeles Times saying the climate change fire alarm from Northern California. People are definitely focused on that connection. Aaron Baldessari is with us, reports for the Mercury News out of San Jose and the East Bay Times out of Walnut Creek, California. Aaron, I've got friends in Sebastopol right next to Santa Rosa whose house was full of effectively wildfire refugees. More relatives, family well south of San Francisco, who said it smelled like, you know, they woke up 10 days ago and thought it smelled kind of nice, like a fire in the fall, until they figured out what was going on. So many miles to the north, everything was burning, Aaron.
Yeah, we've seen some really smoky conditions in the Bay Area. They've actually recorded the highest soot levels that have ever been recorded in the Bay Area. One spokesperson for our air district, our air quality management district, compared it to Beijing on a bad day. And certainly people were waking up and thinking that fires were closer to them, thinking that they were next door just because of the smoke that's coming down from the North Bay.
A toxic mess now left behind by the wildfires. Things melted down and in trouble there. And, of course, the danger of the smoke inhalation itself, and that spreading over a very wide area. Aaron Baldessari, please stand by there if you'd be good enough. I want to welcome two more voices into our conversation right here. Daniel Berlant is with us from Sacramento, the state capital. He's Assistant Deputy Director, Chief of Planning, Risk Analysis, and Fire Engineering and Investigations at the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Daniel, thank you very much for being with us today. Mr. Berlant, are you there?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thank you very much for joining us today. If I may, also welcome Scott Stevens. He's in Walnut Creek, California, outside of San Francisco, professor of fire science in the Department of Environment, Science, Policy, Management at UC Berkeley, director of the UC Center for Fire Research and Outreach. Scott Stevens, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, Tom.
Daniel Berlant, can you give us the latest in terms of the damage done here? Do you keep track of that? We're reading 7,000 structures and 42 lives. Does that capture it?
Yeah, these fires have been very destructive, all starting October 8th. We had over 250 new wildfires that ignited in about a week and a half period. 21 of those became large fires, burning over 245,000 acres, taking 11,000 firefighters to battle those fires, but they were very destructive. Over 100,000 people were evacuated. 42 of those people died, and at our latest estimate, 7,700 structures were destroyed, many of those homes, commercial buildings, and other types of structures.
Daniel, California is no stranger to wildfires. What was familiar about these fires, and what was different?
Every year we see wildfires in California. Our dry Mediterranean climate lends itself naturally to wildfires. What made this series of fires so different is a number of combinations. We have to go back now several years, the fact that we're coming off of what was 5 years of drought conditions. So then we got substantial rain this past winter. That allowed a lot of the brush to just soak up that water and soak up that moisture. And we saw more brush, more grass crop than we had seen in a number of years. So now, as we are throughout, the summer and the fall months have passed, that brush, that grass has dried out, tinder dry. Then you add significant winds that lowered the humidity that night. All it took was a simple spark, and the fires grew very rapidly.
Scott Stevens, what about the timing of these fires? The California fire season goes deeper into the fall. Were these early? What about the timing, Scott?
Yes, October is then one of our most notorious, I hate to say, months. We had the Oakland Hills fire in 1991, and we've had quite a few fires in this month where we really have very little influence from the Pacific Ocean. We get really kind of more of a inland influence and is warmer temperatures. So October has been a really active month, and we do know that climate change research shows that our fire season is extending. We're getting a longer period during the year when fires can ignite and move.
What about the temperature of these fires? Is that consistent in wildfires? I'm reading one report here saying the fires were so hot that car wheels made of aluminum has a melting point of 1,220 degrees Fahrenheit, turned into puddles. Does that mean the fire was that hot, and is that typical, Scott?
Unfortunately, it is. Temperatures of fires in this range, when you have houses, also wildland vegetation, really can be in that value or higher, and unfortunately can do things like melt aluminum and actually cause great harm.
Apart from the timing, you say the climate change may be extending the fire season earlier. What else struck you? We heard from Daniel. What else struck you as different or notable about these very destructive fires, Scott Stevens?
Yes, I think the way it moved so quickly, the one fire that was terrible started north of Calistoga, California. The wind blew it about 12 to 14 miles and maybe 2 hours over a small mountain range, actually. And it comes down, unfortunately, and hits Santa Rosa, causes terrible damage. And then it penetrates into this neighborhood that we all are just a little surprised, Coffee Park, which is on the other side of a major freeway. Embers come in, start fires there, and then, unfortunately, most of us, 1,000 houses are lost, really more of an urban fire. So it kind of penetrated very terribly into a more of an urban setting after it burning through the wildlands.
Aaron Baldessari, we've seen these images of big neighborhoods, just nothing but sort of rectangle after rectangle of ash. Is that what Scott's talking about there in Santa Rosa?
I mean, yes, exactly. There's neighborhoods that were completely decimated. We're all used to seeing wildfires in heavily forested areas. We're not used to seeing them in urban areas. I mean, I think the only precedent for that was the Oakland Hills fire the panelists mentioned in 1991. But the scope of this devastation was certainly unprecedented.
And the worst damage, Daniel Berlant, was it there in Santa Rosa? Or what's the pattern of damage here? What kind of structures? What about the vineyards themselves, Daniel?
Yeah, we saw widespread destruction on a number of fires, but the heaviest hit was the neighborhood in Santa Rosa from the Tubbs fire. Right now, over 4,500 homes have been confirmed to have been destroyed in that fire, making this fire the most destructive fire in our state's history. And as you mentioned, there's been a lot of damage to the agricultural crops, wine, specifically in the North Bay region. But in total, again, trying to imagine 7,700 structures, mostly homes, destroyed by these fires. The residential homes hit the hardest. And what's so important to note is that these aren't just homes that are destroyed because the fire approaches them and then burns up to them. We're talking embers that are raining down half mile, a mile ahead of the actual fire itself. And these thousands of embers are raining down on the homes, igniting one home on fire. It goes up. And with the winds, the flames move right to the next home, and it becomes a domino effect. And that's why you see images of just complete neighborhoods wiped out. Again, embers really being one of the worst enemies for us in a fire like this.
Daniel, we had a call already from a Californian, not in California now, but who said her brother is just kind of giving up here, that when you get that scale of destruction, and he's concerned about climate change, he's thinking this just isn't habitable. You're talking about 4,500 homes destroyed in one community. That is a mind-boggling number. What do you say to people who look and say, how do we come back in that kind of setting where I guess this could happen again?
Well, first, we are seeing it get worse. Again, wildfires are a natural part of our environment. But if you look at the amount of destruction that's been done in the past couple of decades, most of the most destructive fires have happened here since 2000. So as was mentioned by Scott, we are seeing longer fire seasons. We're seeing more year-round conditions in many areas that allow us to see these fires that are burning so much more erratically than ever before. There are things we can do. It's not as if we need to move out of California.
Right.
We have to adapt to it, and that's where we've really taken steps to change our building codes in California to ensure that we have homeowners that have defensible space, are building with homes or building with materials that are ember resistant. These are all things that we're working towards to really help us be more adapted to these type of fire conditions.
Scott Stevens, how effective can those measures be? You've got people watching others escape, you know, with just seconds or not escape at all and lose everything in these fires and wondering, wow, does that really work? Can you change building codes and build communities resistant to this scale of fire?
You can improve it, you know, but you can't reduce it to zero by any means. And Daniel's right about just the intensity of this, event causing so much damage. And I think it was Karen's brother lost hope. And there is hope. You know, you can do better. And as you know, doing better with building codes, trying to actually do better with your vegetation. The other thing you can do, too, is actually be more community-minded in terms of maybe you have some conversations with your community members and you know the next person down the street is actually in a wheelchair. Maybe a person that's across the street is 80 years old, doesn't drive anymore. So when a fire like this happens, you can actually then think, oh, my goodness, I'm going to try to maybe help some people in my neighborhood because they're so, you know, different things going on with their lives. And I think you have to have more conversations at that level and also think about how you can mitigate some of these things at the community level and also the city level and actually understand that a lot of communities in California really are similarly at risk.
Lexi in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Lexi, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was calling because I just returned from a trip out to Bay Area to visit some family.
Yeah.
The very first day I was out there, I went to UC Berkeley and got curious, wanted to go see my sorority house out there.
Yeah.
I saw one of the sisters, and she said that usually she has a four-bridge view from her window in that house.
In other words, a whole lot of horizon she could normally see. Yeah.
Yeah, by that day, you could not even see the bay. By the time I got outside of the house, the smoke had, like, covered the air so thickly that you could look up directly at the sun, and it was just bright red. It was just pink and hazy everywhere.
And I heard the same thing from all around the area, from friends and family there. Lexi, I appreciate your call. Just really dominated the whole area. Eric in Spokane, Washington. Eric, good to hear from you. We were in Spokane talking about wildfire just last month, and here it is taking over California, Northern California. What are you thinking, Eric?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, when you were here, you saw the conditions that we had in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, rough.
The West in general. Never had such unbelievably heavy smoke for persisting for so long in the region, but we had over 26 active large fires in the Pacific Northwest alone over a two-month period.
Yeah, terrible.
But my question for the gentleman from Walnut Creek is this ignition pattern does not seem to point to a natural event. Simultaneous ignition points in such widespread destruction, this is not a lightning-caused event. Where's the human element come in here, and what level of suspicion does he have in terms of cause?
Aaron, Scott, Daniel, let me come first to you with that. What about the cause?
So it is not unusual when we have these large-scale sieges like we were under to see the cause being from multiple different types of reasons. We're still actively investigating how these fires sparked. We are in many cases able to rule out lightning. Lightning is really the only natural cause that we have. 95% of the wildfires that we respond to here in California are caused somehow by the activity of humans. So whether it's accidental, negligence, our infrastructure, or arson, those are our leading causes, and that's what we're following in on. We've got over two dozen investigators that, since day one, have been out on the fire lines working to figure out where the fire started and then what caused them.
Mm.
Those investigations are continuing, but again, we've had sieges like this every decade or so, 2003, 2007, 2008, and then this year, where we have a dozen-plus fires all burning at the same time. And if you look at the past history, a lot of times, we're we're going to find a number of different sources. It's just too early right now to tell what sparked these fires.
We talked with Stephen Pine, a big wildfire expert at Arizona State University. He was looking at downed power lines, his best assessment. But we'll look more at that and much more with Daniel Berlant there at the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Scott Stevens at UC Berkeley with us today and from Walnut Creek, California. And Aaron Baldessari with us from Oakland. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about those super deadly, destructive wildfires California has just come through. Northern California, Sonoma, Napa, and more. Toting up the damage and the lessons learned. With Daniel Berlant, he's with the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, with us from Sacramento. Scott Stevens from Walnut Creek joining us today. He's a professor in fire science at UC Berkeley. Aaron Baldessari is a reporter for the Mercury News in San Jose and the East Bay Times out of Walnut Creek. Been reporting on all of this since October 9th when things really took off out there. You can join us. What do you see as the lesson in these fires? Would you have the courage to rebuild right where everything was torched? Can we rebuild smarter? Can anything withstand this kind of fire? And what does it mean for California if this is the present and the future? Dave writes to us, we have friends who lost everything. They said they were awoken in the middle of the night and barely had enough time to escape with their lives. And there are many, many stories like that. Sadly, many did not escape. 42 at this point deaths reported out of these fires. Sean in New Orleans is calling. Sean, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I just want to say how much I love these programs. I listen to them all the time. But
great.
Beyond that, I grew up in California, in Northern California in particular. So I watched the effects of, I guess, deforestation, the logging industry, cutting down lots of trees. And then when they moved out, then usually either real estate development would come in or other types of crops would come in. And then these homes are all built out of lumber, so you have these massive kindling reserves for fires to go through all these residential areas. And then later on, living in southern Oregon, I saw the same kind of thing, where these massive deforestations of areas and these huge wildfires, which I don't remember that much as a child growing up in those areas.
Mm. And what's your question out of all that, Sean?
I guess in terms of how they're going to either build or organize communities in ways that accept that this climate change is also fueling all of these processes, and more ideas about how we actually plan to build environments that people live in.
Yeah. So let us pick it up. Scott Stevens, I mean, I guess first your thoughts on there's some kind of ratio here. There seems to be a consensus that climate change is driving no small part of this. And at the same time, as our caller in New Orleans with the West Coast background describes, you've had changes, big changes in land use in recent decades, in density of the human population in these areas. What about the climate change factor first, Scott? And then how can California build or organize differently to withstand if this is the future?
Well, it's true. You know, we've had these big fires in California, and we've heard earlier that the ideas of smoke and the inundation of smoke. One thing I might point out is, you know, we did an estimate of what used to burn in California pre-1800.
Mm-hmm.
That's when only Native Americans and, you know, lightning ignited
yep.
fires
yep.
primarily. We estimated 4.5 million acres a year burned in this state. That's a big number. And even the most severe numbers we have today, when we have these horrific losses, maybe 20% of that,
mm-hmm.
then the state was smoking. I'm convinced the state had a lot of smoke in the air, probably until we had season-ending rains.
Mm-hmm.
So that just is a backdrop of the state is basically a pyro state. It's actually Mediterranean climate, vegetation that burns, and then it's actually part of the ecology sometimes, and sometimes actually can cause damage even to the ecology of the system. So that is a backdrop. I think we've heard that we just have to do better at actually trying to live here. And that means better, you know, building construction, better ability to maybe work as communities. Helps us, I think, reduce the risk and actually do a little better. But we're not going to ever bring it to zero.
But, I mean, you do have all that deep history. And, of course, when 4.5 million acres burned, if they were that many, I mean, That was virgin timber with all kinds of undergrowth, presumably. They didn't have industrial logging going on in those days. They certainly didn't have our kinds of firefighting capacity, but they also didn't have anything near the density. Now, California's had a pretty strong, big population for a while. And in earlier decades, our callers are saying they don't recall fires of, as Daniel says, we didn't have fires of this scope and intensity. So something's changing there, Scott.
No, you're right. You know, one thing for sure is more building. There was actually a very large fire in 1968 that actually just missed Santa Rosa or burned into the outskirts. So that was a period of much lower density of homes, much lower really potential to have terrible losses. And this actually is something that's throughout California, as you say. We have so many homes that are built, and they're expanding essentially the vulnerability. So inevitably, unfortunately, a big place like Santa Rosa gets hit by one. So we do need to build smarter. We also need to do better at communications. I worry a little bit about the ideas, you know, these fires move very quickly. We've heard that. And some folks I know actually are waiting maybe on their smartphones trying to think they're going to get some sort of message from somebody that tells them what to do. There isn't time for that, actually. That's why you have to really have an assessment. Maybe your community, you had that conversation with your community members, maybe the fire service. So when something like that happens, you have to act. I'm afraid people, with all the technology we have today, it's not going to solve that problem.
You talk about adapting the, let's say, the residential home what population there. Do you have to move away from wooden homes? Is that possible?
You can. I mean, you can use wood as long as it's, you know, has siding on it and things of that nature. So the core of the house still can be wood, but the exterior, stucco, other materials, double pane windows gives you more protection. Roofs that basically are really resistant to ember attack. All that really helps us. And then certainly the way you have your vegetation around your home, keeping it more away, a little bit of insulation. All that really does help the ability to survive a system like this. But even all that isn't going to guarantee, again, success.
I mean, Aaron, from the stories, from what you saw in this fire, you could, I think you could probably have pretty good fire hygiene and still be in trouble, Aaron.
Certainly. And, you know, one of the lessons that was learned from the 1991 Oakland Hills fire, you know, the communities in the Oakland and Berkeley Hills set up a wildfire prevention assessment district. So that was basically a special tax that they paid to kind of do the group clearing of dried brush and other fuels each year. They would actually, you know, they actually bring in goats to graze and get rid of some of the grasses. And they have, you know, sort of higher standards for how, what the other panelists mentioned, you know, defensible space around the homes. That fire prevention district actually expired in 2014. It didn't quite have the votes it needed to keep going. But there were a number of building changes, building code changes that were resulted as part of that fire in terms of having exterior walls that can, you know, withstand, you know, an hour of fire. And things of that nature. I think they tried to also have sprinklers become a requirement, but that was rejected by the community because it was too expensive. That is a requirement. That subsequently became a requirement. You know, there are things that people can do, you know, but I think the other panelist is correct that, you know, I don't need to completely prevent the possibility of wildfires.
It's hard to keep up the resolve and those practices in the years between these big fires, but these huge fires make it people's attention again. Let's take a call from San Francisco. Eric is calling from San Francisco. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Hello, Eric. Whoop, we just lost Eric. Let's go to Kristen in Nashville. Kristen, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Thanks
for having me on.
Yeah.
Good. Hey, we just moved back from Santa Rosa last year, back to our native home in Nashville here. And I just wanted to say that this is an incredibly special place to be, Santa Rosa is.
Mm-hmm.
When we were there, we just were so welcomed. And within a year, we began to feel like it was a piece of our hearts and our home. And honestly, I hated to leave. I wanted to stay there. And my husband's job, we got transferred back here, but I guess in hindsight, sometimes unanswered prayers are best. But I just wanted to call some attention to that particular area and say that, you know, California to us in Nashville, we feel like it's so far away, it's so far out there. it's another world, but it's not. I mean, these people, they need our help, and they're going to need our help for a long time to come. Our friends, I feel like, are going through some post-traumatic stress disorder already. You know, they've explained being woken up in the middle of the night by screaming neighbors and falling embers, and they have really gone through a lot. And my hope is that the rest of the country will keep this disaster in their thoughts and prayers and donate to causes, because this is an area where the income gap is enormous. You have the ultra wealthy, and then you have a ton of already homeless people. And so I just feel like it's such an incredibly special place. And I know exactly where that Tubbs fire was. My hair salon burnt down. The stores and restaurants we used to shop at, they burned. And I feel so connected to this cause. My husband and I started a gift card drive here in Franklin, Tennessee, and we're collecting for them. And I just want everyone to know what a special place it is out there.
Special and really hit hard in these last couple of weeks. Daniel Berlant in Sacramento, what about the communications here to alert people when these fires are coming? They were very fast moving. Some just did not get out, did not get the word in time. And we've heard, don't just rely on technology, but there are alert systems, right? I mean, in Sonoma, Napa, where text messages are sent on mobile phones. And then what about there's a more aggressive Amber Alert system where everybody, I think, is text messages and screeching alarms. Were those used in this case, Daniel?
You know, we are living in an era where we are reliant on our communication tools, our cell phones, and being able to access information immediately. You have to remember, many of these residents were asleep. These fires occurred overnight. So that's always an additional challenge, trying to do a mass evacuation when people are asleep. Now, the Sheriff's Department and our law enforcement partners, we work very closely with them to try to alert them as quickly as possible of what we believe a fire may do, so that they can make the notifications and or the plans to evacuate a community. There are systems where phone calls can be made, but we're also living in a time when many people don't have a home phone anymore. So reverse 911 systems are that may have worked 5 to 10 years ago, that adds an additional challenge. Cell phone alerts, as you mentioned, we are in California. We do have now an Amber Alert system that allows for phone notifications. And in some of those systems, residents have to pre-sign up to ensure that they get notifications from their law enforcement agency. So if this has taught us anything, the first item is make sure that you are connected to your local law enforcement agency's notification system. In the county that I live in, you have to opt in. You give them your cell phone number or the numbers you want, so you can receive those type of notifications 24/7. The number one thing that we always tell people is don't necessarily wait for an evacuation notice, because in a fire like this that burns at such a rapid rate, there may not be time for an actual evacuation notification to be made. Again, overnight, it's a huge challenge. How do you get people who are asleep to get out of an area? But during the day or after multiple days of a fire, we want residents to be prepared, and we want them to evacuate early. We have a lot of information that we provide to the public on ways to ensure that you have an evacuation plan in place before an actual evacuation occurs.
San Francisco calling. Eric in San Francisco. You're on the air, Eric.
Hey, Tom. How are you? I just wanted to say that I live in the southern part of the city, and from our house, you can normally see the Marin Headlands and the Golden Gate Bridge, but during the time of the fires, it was totally smogged over, and it was pretty disconcerting. And just to say that, you know, with all the fires up there, it's made me rethink my emergency packets here at home. We have food, we have water, but I've also started going around taking photos of important documents, passwords, and accounts. It's very important.
So that you could carry them with you. And you're feeling that concern, Eric, even living, I guess, in San Francisco?
Oh, yeah, because we're going to get an earthquake. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of problems. And it's disconcerting, and you have to think of these things. I have a sister that lives in Carlisle. She's thinking of these things.
Yeah. Taking extraordinary measures, even in San Francisco. Of course, California has a number of angles there that people have to think about. Earthquake, too, but this time it's fire. Eric, I appreciate your call. Scott, I mean, we're reading here in the LA Times, they're saying this is a fire alarm about climate change. Let me just read you what they write. I want to get your response. They say California is fortunate to have a governor, they're talking about Jerry Brown, who understands the perils of ignoring climate change and is aggressively pushing policies to mitigate its future harm. Then they write, unfortunately, this is the LA Times, that puts him at odds with a head-in-the-sand president who blithely disregards the obvious connection between the warming climate and the multiple federal disaster areas he's been forced to declare in Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and now California. Long-term, Scott, what about this California focus, at least, on trying to battle climate change as part of the battle against wildfire?
Well, I fully agree, because it is something that's going to impact the entire globe. It is impacting the globe. And if we can do better in terms of trying to mitigate emissions, trying to actually reduce greenhouse gas and then temperature. But I would say still that, you know, just the character of California in terms of Mediterranean climate, mm-hmm. dry summer every year, productive soils, pretty good precipitation in winter, we really are set up to burn. So, yes, climate change is actually changing that trajectory some, but we have a backdrop of just a place that actually is adapted to burn and will continue even without climate change. Climate change is making it more difficult.
Aaron, what about all those who lost their homes, thousands and thousands of homes? Where are they staying?
A lot of people are staying with family and friends. Some people are in hotels. Other folks that I spoke to have had to go as far away as Oakland or Marin, about 60 miles away, in order to find rental homes. But the housing market is already incredibly tight in the Bay Area, and this just really exacerbated it and made it a lot harder and a lot worse for folks who are trying to find places, especially while they rebuild, to live in the meantime.
An astonishing couple of weeks in Sonoma, in Napa, Santa Rosa in particular, but beyond, Northern California there, and we wish the best and a good recovery and a smart future for all those affected. Very grateful to the three of you for being with us this hour. Aaron Baldessari, reporting for the Mercury News and for the East Bay Times. Thank you very much for being with us today, Aaron.
Thank you.
Daniel Berlant at the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection in Sacramento today. Daniel, thank you for your observations here.
Thanks.
And Scott Stevens, at the Professor of Fire Science at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Stevens, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Stay safe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.